Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 356, I chat with journalists Chris Chinnick and Mike Heiss about the future of displays as seen at Display Week 2017. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded June 1st, 2017, episode 356, The Future of Displays. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of absforum.com. This week, I have two guest geeks joining me. First up is Chris Chinnick, founder and president of Insight Media. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
Happy to have you here. Also, one of my regulars, always happy to have him here, Mike Heiss, industry consultant, journalist, analyst, and general bon vivant. Mike, welcome.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Always a pleasure to be here.
And a jolly good CEDIA fellow as well.
Indeed. Thank you.
Hey, those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv. And you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps to put my screen name in the message, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces or anything, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen. So today we're going to talk about a conference, an annual conference that just happened last week that we all attended called Display Week. So Chris, give us a sense of what is Display Week.
Well, it's really, as you say, it is for display geeks. There's a lot of advanced display technology there. This is the kind of stuff that a lot of universities go to, that a lot of display development companies go to. And you'll see stuff and papers and exhibits on display technology and some current products. But more importantly, you'll see demonstrations and papers on technology on displays that will be in future products. Could be a year, 2 years. Some of the work is even 3, 4, 5 years out or longer.
Yeah, and it's a super geek fest, Mike. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. What I was going to say is a lot of the shows that we go to and talk about are shows where you talk about what you saw that you could buy. This is a show where the people who make the stuff that you buy go to buy stuff.
Right. It's like 2 degrees of separation from the actual product. So we buy a TV. TV manufacturers buy LEDs. LEDs are made by certain companies, and then they buy the raw materials from other companies. And so some of the stuff we saw this time was seriously inside baseball. Most of it, you know, at this show, it's very inside baseball. So I want everyone to put on their propeller hats because we're going to take a serious ride here. It's produced by the Society for Information Display, or SID. And I have to tell you, Chris, what do you think? Is it pronounced SID or SID?
I hear it both ways.
You hear it both ways.
I usually hear SID.
SID, okay. Because CEDIA is pronounced as a word. CES, I don't think you could pronounce as a word, so it's spelled out. NAB is usually spelled out, but it could be called NAB. So these names of these companies, these organizations, who knows? Anyway, Society for Information Display, SID, or SID, is what we're really talking about here today. And Chris, you sent me a list of a few things that you thought we would talk about. And one of the most important, I think, is what's called color conversion. So give us an overview of what that means.
So color conversion is important because there are a lot of emerging technologies that will take light of one color, blue in particular, and turn it into red and green. You've heard of quantum dots, and there's a whole bunch of different quantum dot technologies that do that. But also phosphors can do this too. The ag phosphors and other phosphors take blue light and turn it into broader spectrum or more specific colors. And now the emerging micro LED market is also starting to do this as well. A lot of that technology starts with blue, but you need red and green as well.
That's right. And part of the issue here is that the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency of the light, the more energy it carries. And so starting with blue is sort of the highest energy light that we can see. I mean, violet would be more, but let's say blue. Sure. And then it hits something like a quantum dot or a phosphor. And what the quantum dot or phosphor emits is red or green, lower energy, which means that some energy is lost. It has to be. There's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. That's kind of how it works. And we have a couple of graphics of quantum dots. We've talked about quantum dots on the show before. And this was very big at Display Week. We have Nanosys QD bottles and Fraunhofer QD bottles. And just wanted to show those. There's the Nanosys ones. And that's, you can't tell by the photograph, but it's actually those bottles of liquid are full of these tiny microscopic quantum dots that are lit from below with a blue light. And one bottle has green ones and one has red. Mike, you took this picture at Fraunhofer, right?
Yep, and don't drink that stuff. but yeah, actually, really. I everybody knows I like to joke, but that's actually serious, because one of the things that the quantum dot people are trying to deal with is to get the cadmium out of this, because there's an environmental issue for some of these things.
Right, a big environmental issue. In fact, Nanosys, which was one of those pictures there, introduced and, in fact, got an award for their Hyperion quantum dots, which use very little cadmium. Chris, I don't know, did you attend the awards luncheon?
I didn't, but I'm familiar with the Hyperion.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the Hyperion and what's important there.
So as Mike mentioned, there's a RoHS is an environmental standard, and they have an exemption right now for certain quantum dot materials to go into TVs that allow a higher level of cadmium than would normally be allowed. But they don't want to continue this exemption. So the big push has been to move from cadmium-based quantum dots to cadmium-free quantum dots, and everyone's kind of pushing in this direction right now. And Nanosys has historically made cadmium-based quantum dots. That was their kind of the first generation. And they're working on the cadmium-free. But as an interim step, they developed this Hyperion one, which is basically a mix of both of these technologies. So they've got, I believe it's the red is the cadmium base and the green is the cadmium-free, or vice versa. I forget which.
I think it's the other way around, to tell you the truth. Yeah. They say the green one is low cadmium, but it still has some, and the red is cadmium free. But here we are looking at the color gamut of the Hyperion quantum dots. And this is one of the more important things about quantum dots, is that they are reaching for a range of colors, which we call BT2020, which is roughly where that, I mean, if you can zoom in, Josh, to that triangle. We can see that BT2020 is one of those triangles, and the Hyperion quantum dots is the other one, and it's very close. They're very close together. Hyperion quantum dots are said to have over 90% of the BT2020 color gamut. This is important because of something called wide color gamut. And TVs today are showing a wider range of colors than HD TVs have done up till now. So, Mike, you've looked a lot at wide color gamut. Do you think that 2020 is something worth reaching for?
Well, what all of this is proving is that the display manufacturers, and again, that's what Display Week's all about, will be able to create displays that can actually show 2020. Because for a while, as you know, Scott, you could only get that with fancy laser projectors like the big Christie's and Barco's. And right. This will bring things like that Hyperion will bring it down into consumer availability. I don't know if you have the graphic where it shows the Hyperion thing with the London phone booth on the corner.
That's called Object versus 2020. And that's a graphic you gave me. And you can, when we pull it up here, you'll be able to tell us what we're looking at, why 2020 is in fact important.
There you go. Thanks. And that illustrates why the 2020 is important, because things like a London phone box, I don't know about, well, if you go down to the lower right, maybe the TARDIS. So if you wanted to see... No, go back to the phone box. If you wanted to see a true Coke can color, or a red London phone box, or a U.S. safety yellow school bus, or a New York City cab, within P3 or 709, you really can't see that. And 2020 will bring the ability to see those things as they actually exist in an affordable display, you know, that's not a $300,000 laser projector.
Right, exactly.
And the thing that's important to point out about that graphic is that squiggly line there. That's called pointer's gamut. That's the range of all the natural colors that you can see. But you got to keep in mind there are computer-generated colors that go beyond that as well.
Mm. And, Which becomes important for games and stuff like that.
Yeah, any animated movie, for example, can push those colors out.
Yeah.
But Scott, if you could go back to the previous graphic, the Hyperion one, Chris raises a really interesting point that a lot of what 2020 can do is better. So if you look at the pointer, that gray outline, that actually shows what Chris was just talking about, that 2020 in some cases exceeds what the eye can see from a visible image.
From reflected
natural colors.
Natural colors. Yeah.
Natural colors from reflected light. So the reason we can see anything in the real world is that light gets reflected off of it and comes into our eye. And that painter's gamut, what did you call it again? Pointer's gamut. Yeah. Is the all the colors that you can see by reflected light in the real world. But of course, the eye, that horseshoe-shaped part of that image is what the eye can actually discern or perceive. The human visual system, HVS, we were talking about this before the show started. And as you say, Chris, computers can generate that. And so animation and so on. So we really want displays that can reproduce as much of that as possible. And so far, what we've got in the field, shall we say, is what's called DCI P3, which is smaller. It has a less wide range of colors than 2020. And there are no displays other than those really expensive laser projectors so far that can really reproduce 2020. So everything we see in the commercial cinema at home is no more than P3. So at Display Week, really, they're talking about how can we get to 2020. Both in professional applications and in consumer products as well. Because then when someone makes a movie and they shoot it and they capture it with a wide color gamut and they master it to 2020 and the consumer can see it in 2020, that's sort of the holy grail.
And as somebody said, the end game of this, I asked the fellow from Nanosys, and he said that we'll be seeing some sets that include that Hyperion technology at CES.
Right, exactly. Well, color conversion isn't only quantum dot. Chris, you saw something from a Pixel Display, and I tried to talk to them myself, and they were very tight-lipped about it.
Oh, yes.
Man, oh, man. We have one picture that you were able to score, and maybe you got a little farther with them than I did. What did you learn about pixel display?
Well, they weren't too forthcoming with me either, to tell you the truth. But from what I'm gathering, they are doing a phosphor-based solution, but they're adding some additional layers to this that appear to be designed to narrow the emission width within the red, green, and blue parts of the spectrum.
Right.
So what's really good...
If we have pixel display figure 3, we should be able to see that. There it is.
Yeah, there you go. So what's really important about this is these are very narrow full width half max. This is 10 nanometers wide band gaps. That's half to a third of what you can get with the best quantum dots right now.
Mm.
So this, in theory, this should allow you to go out, push you way out to fulfill that 2020 color gamut. The problem is, you see, in the green spectrum, you get a little blue bump, and in the blue one, you've got a little green bump at the bottom.
Yep. Yep.
That's from the color filters in a standard LCD. Those color filters are very broad compared to these narrow widths, so you get a little leakage into these nice clean spikes here.
How interesting.
And that's what brings you their color gamut coverage way down.
Right.
I shouldn't say way down, but it reduces
but somewhat.
It from what
yeah,
it should
yeah,
be.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Hey, Chris, how would that compare to the electroemissive quantum dot things that NanoSys was talking about that are, you know, really sort of more like an old electroluminescent type of thing?
That would not have that problem because there's no color filters in that case. Now you'd still have a wider full width half max than that 10 nanometers. It'd be, you know, again, 20, 30, 40, depending on what materials they used. But that would be very close to being able to fill that 2020 gamut.
Right, exactly. Now, Mike, you mentioned photoemissive, and I want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about here. We're getting back to quantum dots now, and quantum dots have sort of a roadmap that we see into the future. Let's take a look, in fact, at the graphic called NanoSys Roadmap. Start with that, and we'll see what is being done with quantum dots currently. At the top of this graphic, the first thing here, we have a backlight, which is blue. We have a quantum dot film, which has green and red quantum dots kind of buried in it. And that they emit red and green. That combines with the blue that isn't absorbed from the backlight, giving us white light. Then it passes through color filters, red, green, and blue color filters. And then finally, we see the final display. Chris, go to the next step here and tell us about color filter replacement.
So instead of putting the quantum dots in the backlight in a film, the idea is to move the quantum dots, at least the red and the blue ones, to the color filter on the front of the display. In the previous one, you generate white light, and whenever you pass it through the color filter, you're still throwing away two-thirds of the light. That's the way all LCDs work today.
Mm-hmm.
In the photoemissive approach, now you start with that blue backlight. You pass that through the LCD panel, and then you've got a clear subpixel for the blue and then quantum dots that are patterned for red and green, and use that blue light now to emit red and green.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, theoretically, it could be three times as efficient, so a third of the power, or three times as bright.
At the same power.
But there will be... Yeah. At the same power. Now, it'll be less than that in reality, of course.
Yeah.
But this technology is moving along very well. And I know NanoSys and others now have the materials to be able to do this. But there's an additional problem. You have to move the polarizer, which would normally be near the color filters. You have to move that inside the LCD part now, which is a change in process and requires new technology development. So that's not a NanoSys problem. That's a display maker problem. And they're working on that in parallel.
Right, exactly. We have another graphic to illustrate the difference between those two systems that we just looked at called NanoSys Photo Enhanced versus Emissive. And we'll be able to see here what you were talking about. The backlight going through the quantum dot film, and then going through the LCD shutters and then through the filters, as opposed to quantum dot filter replacement, which does exactly as you just said. And it's going to be more efficient. NanoSys told me we might even see prototypes of this kind of TVs with this kind of technology at CES next January.
I think it's likely.
Mike, go ahead.
No, it's interesting, though, that showing those graphs is one of the ways that the OLED people were saying we're better because we don't need no stinking filters. And that's why they claim efficiency. I don't know if I sent you the cutaway of the LG single sheet for an OLED versus all the layers.
Yeah, you did. And it's called OLED QLED. No, it's called... wait a second. Oh, LG OLED versus LCD. That's what it's called.
And so, that sort of illustrates the point because there you go. So to show in real life what we've been talking about, if you go 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth piece of the LCD from the front is the quantum dot sheet that Chris was just talking about. So what the... OLED people are saying, we don't need all those other bloody things. You got a panel and that's it. So you get clear. Now, this is their pitch, better color and higher efficiency. There are pros and cons to both, but I just thought that might be a good physical representation.
True. Now, I have to say that LG uses white OLED material and color filters on their OLED TVs. Chris, you were about to make that point, I'll bet.
Well, that is one of the points. The other point is, while they don't have all those physical film layers, they've got probably 15, 17, maybe even 20 actual layers that they have to lay down to create that OLED stack. So they're thin, but they're still layers. And
still a bunch of layers.
Steps.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, disclaimer, that was in the LG booth.
True.
Right, exactly, exactly. Barfel is saying that that's what quantum dots do. They don't filter, they re-emit. And that's exactly what we're talking about here in terms of color conversion, which is they absorb blue light at a higher energy and they emit yellow or green or blue or red light, which is at a lower energy. The difference between a quantum dot film, such as is used today, where we still have it basically is used to generate white light, and then we have color filters that throw away a lot of light and so on and so forth. The quantum dot, there you have to have some of the blue light pass through the quantum dots. It can't be fully blocked and totally absorbed. Whereas in these color filter replacements, it must be fully absorbed as much as possible. NanoSys told me that they were getting 99% absorption, less than 1% of the blue light is getting past those color filter replacements, which I guess would give you a tiny little blue bump in the green and the red, but not very much.
Right.
So that's the next step, which we might very well see next year in some products. Chris, you think it's likely we'll see at CES some quantum dot color filter replacement prototypes at the least.
I do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting. Mike?
Yeah. No, I agree. Chris is right on the money.
Yeah. If we go back, though, to the NanoSys roadmap graphic, we'll see the third step in the process, which we think is, Mike, you said you thought maybe 2021.
Yeah. I'm just looking down at my notes, and the fellow from NanoSys said 2021.
Right. And so what that is Mike, why don't you tell us what that is?
Well, that actually, let me just look down at my notes. It's quantum dots actually on the substrate. So if you just see the peak at the thing above where, you know, you're having these different layers, that's kind of putting it all together. But if you look at the left-hand side where it says processability, this is really dependent, and Chris, please correct me if I'm wrong, that this really depends on printing, that they really want to print these displays, which will also make them flexible, but it's not quite there yet.
No, and the key issue here is that the quantum dots are being stimulated to glow not by light, not by being hit by blue light, but by being hit with an electronic voltage.
Right, and again, it says in the top line there, attractive future emitter material for electroluminescent devices. And if anybody remembers the old electroluminescent kind of greenish night lights that you used to be able to buy, or the dashboard in my father's 1961 Chrysler, those those are electroluminescent, and this is a very similar type of thing, that it is an emissive display and not a transmissive display.
Right. It's kind of like OLED, in a sense. OLED material glows when you hit it with a voltage, and this is going to be the same thing. But we're talking a few years down the line.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the Nanosys guy showed me, you guys may have seen it as well. It was kind of in a back room, where they actually took photo-emissive quantum dot material and inkjet printed it. And this is kind of the next step. This was very prototypical. Chris, did you get to see that?
I did not see that, but they showed me some other stuff related to that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they're trying to get the manufacturing cost. And what's that, Mike?
That was in a lot of their papers, that a lot of this stuff, like the flexible displays and the electro emissive and all of that, they're really banking on being able to really print this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, yeah, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say the big news in electro emissive quantum dots at SID was the BOE demo.
Yes.
They actually showed full color for the first time electro-emissive quantum dot displays in two sizes, 14-inch and a 5-inch.
Yeah, and we got a picture of the 5-inch, actually. Let's see if we can take a look at that. Chris, you supplied that, and thank you very much for that.
I don't know why I didn't take one of the 14-inch. That seems
I was kind of disappointed at that, too. But anyway, there's the 5-inch, full color. Electro-emissive quantum dots. So yep. Here the quantum dots are being stimulated by electrical signals, not by light.
Exactly.
And this is the future, I think, of, well, one future of displays, certainly.
And notice it says inkjet printing in the third line on the right.
Exactly so. And Chris, you got a picture of the 14-inch spec sheet, if you will, not a picture of the display itself. Okay, but it was 960 by, what does it say there?
540.
By 540, okay. So, you know, 80 pixels per inch. You know, these are very early prototypes of things. And BOE, we should mention, is one of the big manufacturers of flat panel sub-assemblies, I guess you would say, in China. Am I right about that, Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So they're involved in R&D from their perspective, which is to build the raw panels from which TVs are then made. They sell those to TV makers like Samsung or whoever, and they make TVs out of them. So that was kind of it. I thought that was one of the most interesting things at the show, was to see an electro-emissive, or sometimes called electroluminescent, quantum dot display. Small, low res for sure, but still, we're
defects,
on the way.
Dim, you know, at least the 14 was dim. The 5-inch was a little bit better, but
right.
But right, exactly. The other really cool thing in the BOE display was that bendable thing. I mean, I don't know what you really want to use it for, but it was really trick.
Yeah. Mm. Look at that. This is a bendable OLED, I think, is what we're talking about here.
I believe so.
And there was another one.
They had that one.
Tell us about that one, Mike.
Well, what it's hard to tell because it's a still shot, and I forgot to send the images, is if you see the top half of that, and there's a bar sort of in the middle, and that thing folds around. So I used to joke at Cedia that if you had a 100-inch, the old 103-inch plasmas, you could get them into a house because they bend in the middle, but only once. This actually does bend in the middle. I think I did send you a picture, Scott, of the whole rig where it's folded over. I don't know if that's...
I don't remember. I don't think I sent that one. The one with the three pictures?
No, there's one where the thing is actually bent over. You know, it's bent like this.
Oh, well, so I thought that was the first one. I thought that was BOE bend one.
Is that not the whatever one? But what whatever. They showed was a rig where they had that same display material that everybody just saw, but they would flex it and it would bend like this for the whole show. It was wild.
Mm. Now, I suppose that this will be important for super large wall-sized displays. I mean, we've been promised for years, just like we've been promised jetpacks and flying cars, that we will have rollable, bendable, foldable wall-sized displays that you could roll up and bring into your house and unroll and put up on the wall like wallpaper. And this is pointing to a future where that may very well be true.
Commercial market, the thing that I always used to point to is picture something like a convention center where you've got, or an airport where you've got those big sono tubes used to actually pour concrete, not make subwoofers, that you could wrap a display around them.
Right. Yeah. Right. So for signage, you know, commercial signage, it makes a lot of sense. But of course, this is Home Theater Geek. So my mind always goes towards what can we do in the home. Chris, you had a comment?
Well, the other point is that all these things, there was lots of bendable and flexible and foldable, well, not so much foldable, but the point of all those things is that they mostly fold or bend in one direction.
Oh, really? Samsung, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Samsung had a little darkened area where they were showing a flexible display that could actually deform in two dimensions. So think of this as a little mountain popping up on your display.
Hmm.
But that, I still didn't get that, and I saw it. And the best way to describe it is take a piece of Saran wrap and push it in and see how far it deforms in either direction. And that's kind of what this thing did. And I was really disappointed because when I first read about it before the show, they said, wow, a stretchable display. And I pictured it being like Silly Putty where you can actually stretch it. But it's only 12 degrees in either way. And if I look in my notes, it says what the deviation is, but it was cool.
Yeah, it's only a few
but
millimeters.
Think, yeah, yeah. It's a science project.
Yeah.
One graphic I thought I found very interesting was I forget who supplied it or where it came from, but it was a forecast into the future of OLED versus QLED, and we haven't talked about this term QLED or QLED before, which Samsung has taken to mean kind of any display with quantum dots in it. And they're using it on their current line of displays, which is what we talked about is the first step of the process of quantum dots, which is merely a film with a blue backlight, makes white light, goes through color filters. They're calling that QLED. Mike, you had thought that was actually somebody
branding.
Branding, but it's not.
When it first came out, I thought that QLED was a Samsung brand. And right. In fact, when I went to the unveiling of that set a couple weeks ago up in Woodland Hills, the Samsung guys were all over QLED, QLED, QLED. Then somebody said at the show that they were opening up the word so that everybody could use it. But in all the papers and the sessions, everybody seemed to be taking QLED as a generic thing to stand for a quantum dot based LED system.
So however it might be implemented. One. Yeah, exactly. And that graphic we just saw, I'm sorry, I called it up a little soon. Who gave me that graphic and where did it come from?
I sent that to you, and that's from Display Supply Chain Consultants.
Okay.
They did a white paper that looked at quantum dots or QLED. This is for TVs versus OLED. And their forecast is obviously heavily favoring quantum dots. And it's not necessarily based on performance. It's based on supply chain analysis. It's very easy to convert traditional LCD fabs to be able to become quantum dot or QLED capable because it's just a film, or you're going to put it in the and the color filters. The infrastructure is there. On the other hand, you have to build fabs and very expensive fabs to make OLED TVs, and that takes time and investment, and they just don't see that investment catching up in terms of actual TV sales anytime soon.
But Chris, as the display keeper of the statistics, would you agree that at Display Week, at least, you certainly got the impression that QLED was the way for big displays, but that OLED was going to gain some footing for kind of 5-6 inch phone-ish kinds of displays, that they were trying to push that more towards OLED than other technologies?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Barfel in the chat room is asking a question. Is the problem with red and green LEDs for TV displays that they aren't monochromatic enough, that their spectrum is too wide? Well, most TVs don't use red and green LEDs. Although I want to talk about that in a minute. They use white LEDs, essentially, unless they're using quantum dots, in which case they're using blue LEDs with red and green quantum dots.
There is another phosphorus solution.
Exactly. And that was the next thing I was going to get to. Okay. In fact, Chris, why don't you tell us about radiant red?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, the mainstream approach is a white LED. So, and that's really a blue LED with a YAG phosphor, a very broad emitting yellow that goes on top of the blue and creates a pretty decent white. But it's very broad, and you don't really need a broad light source. And it's also a little weak in the red. So you can either add a little red LED to give it a little boost in the red, which some people do. But most people are adding this red phosphor, a very spiky red phosphor on. It's called KPF.
KSF.
Listen to them.
Don't listen to
KSF.
Or KSF. Hit radio.
Or PFS. Potassium fluorosilicate.
Thank you.
Doped with manganese ions. Talk about inside baseball. So I talked with one of the material scientists at General Electric, who makes this red phosphor that they actually call it trigain, and the resulting spectrum is called radiant red. And unfortunately, I have a picture of it, but I signed a thing that said I can only use it in my article about it. And I thought it might be a legal problem to show it here in a different context. But I did take a picture of the actual, they had a side by side. And so we have a picture called GE Radiant Red that I can show, that at least shows the difference, a comparison between GE's Radiant Red on the left and, you know, a more conventional red phosphor sitting inside the LED to give you sort of the regular red. And in fact, somebody earlier in the chat room asked this question, which I thought was really good, which is, if I can find it. Oh, yeah. I am special. Unless you can compare color, does it really matter? And this is a very interesting question, because if you saw a TV that just had that, what we saw on the right half of that screen, you probably wouldn't say, oh, that red is like more orange. But in a side-by-side, you can really see it. So I find that to be a very interesting argument for, you know, how important is all this?
Well, Scott, you're a calibrator. How much of the delta between the right side and the left side in that picture could you manipulate by monkeying around with the set electronically rather than physically, as you're just talking about?
Not much, because you can't add more saturation than the set can naturally produce. You can take away,
right.
But you can't really make it more saturated. But again, if you don't have a side-by-side comparison, and I do this in reviews, you know, I'm doing this now with an LG OLED. I have it sitting next to the Sony OLED, and I'm going to look at them side-by-side, looking at the same material. So, you know, that's not something most people can do easily. Certainly, you think, well, go to a store and do it there. Well, no, because the stores don't have them set up correctly. So that's a little bit of an exercise in futility. So I do it because I can. Chris, what do you think about the whole issue of comparison and how important are these differences that we're talking about if you can't do a side by side?
Well, make a very good point. That is a very true statement that unless you can see things side by side, we don't have a good memory of just random colors. We have good memory of specific colors, flesh tones and other memory colors, grass and Coke and Ferraris and, you know, things that we know what they should look like. But if we don't know exactly what something should look like and it's off a little bit, we don't know that it's off unless there's a side-by-side comparison.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things that adds into that, I was just looking for a quote, is I was asking someone about color volume as opposed to color space, which is something I'm, looking into a lot these days. And that's where somebody said in response to that, that's why color volume is going to be critical, just for the reason that you suggested, Scott.
Yes, exactly. And Samsung's big on that, and Sony is too. Most of them, I think we're starting to come to a point of looking more at color volume than at color gamut, which color gamut is that triangle inside that horseshoe shape, but that's at one brightness level. That's at, say, 80%, 75 or 80% brightness. But what happens as this picture gets brighter and dimmer? Generally speaking, the colors start to get less saturated. They start to converge on white at the top end or converge on black at the low end. So you end up with this weird looking shape, which I don't have a picture of, I'm sorry to say. I should have sent one along. And that's more to the point of what's going to be important in displays, in TVs particularly, is what happens when it gets bright, what happens when it gets dark. Do the colors retain their saturation into the brights and into the blacks or not? And so that's an issue that we're hearing more and more about. Mike, as you say, color volume is becoming more important. Chris, I think you would agree, right?
There's no doubt that's going to be one of the big topics for 2017 and into 18. But I think the differentiating point becomes when you talk about a traditional LCD versus an OLED or even an LCD that has an RGB and a white element. So when you add the white element, it depends how you process the signal, whether that negatively impacts the color volume or doesn't.
Right.
For example, in the LG OLED TVs, which is an RGB white configuration, in last year's models, if the incoming, this is for HDR now, if the incoming signal said it wanted, you know, 1,000 nits of a certain color, but the OLED TV could not produce that, the philosophy that LG took was, well, we're going to try and give it as much brightness as we can for those pixels, and if it compromises the color, so be it, because adding more white to the RGB will desaturate it and it will not produce the colors that, you know, you might have at a lower brightness level that you would have.
Right.
And so there was some criticism of that. In the 2017 models, they seem to have changed their philosophy, and now they're saying, well, if the signal level exceeds the capabilities of the TV, we're not going to try and push that brightness all the way up. We're going to try and maintain color fidelity, and if the brightness is lower, so be it.
Mm.
And I think that's actually produced a better looking image.
I tend to agree. Looking at the 2016s versus the 2017s, I have to say I agree. Tommy on Trip is asking about the very next topic of conversation here, which is micro LED. And that was another huge topic at Display Week. We saw a bunch of companies doing micro LED. Chris, tell us sort of generally what are we talking about when we talk about micro LED?
So these are LED technology, but a much, much smaller scale, on the order of tens of microns as opposed to millimeters in your traditional LEDs that go into a video wall, for example.
Right.
And they could potentially get...
So 100 times smaller.
Yeah, on that scale.
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah. They can also get a lot brighter, maybe 100,000 to a million times brighter.
Man, that's astonishing.
Yeah,
we saw that at CES in the Sony display called Cletus.
Can I say it?
You can.
If you have Cletus for more than 4 hours, consult your physician immediately.
Thank you.
We're here all week. Tell your friends.
Try the veal. Tip your waitress. Right, exactly. No, Cletus is, I've forgotten what it stands for, something LED
Crystal
integrated.
Light, something, yeah.
Yeah, something or another. Anyway, it's these tiny little microscopic LEDs, and there's a red, a green, and a blue, and they create a full color picture. Now, Chris, you saw a couple of companies that were doing something interesting. Tell us about some of those.
Well, first, let's start with, I think there's a graphic that kind of shows the two different classes of how you make micro LEDs. There's kind of two ways of doing this.
Was this from Lumiode or Leti?
No, I forget what I called it.
Oh, no, I think it's called Yole Micro LED Types.
There you go. So you start with this wafer of micro LEDs, and these are small wafers. These are typically 2 to 4 inches or so. Mm-hmm. And if you want to make a large display, like a Cletus display or some other larger size display, you have to do this pick and place. So, you know, the pixel pitch on the micro LED array might be 10 or 20 microns, and you want to put it on a substrate where it's 100 times that, or 200 times that, or whatever, 1,000 times that.
The substrate, so, in other words, the place where the LED is going to go is quite a bit larger than the LED itself.
Exactly. So you've got to have this way to transfer this very tiny pitch of LEDs to a much larger pitch for your substrate. That's how you make a direct view display from a watch size to a TV size or wall size. And there's a whole bunch of technology to do that. The other way to do it is called monolithic integration. And that's really focused on a micro LED micro display. So you're basically keeping that same pixel pitch, but you're now mating it to a CMOS wafer that has the transistors and drive circuits to actually activate the display now. And you've got to find ways to bond those two different materials together in such a way that you can do this.
And also so that you can then address them electrically.
Yes.
Individually.
Yes.
And it's really, really expensive to the point where I've asked a couple of people, both at SID and elsewhere, about the Samsung cinema display. Versus Cletus. And they said that the Samsung display is considerably less expensive. Or to put it another way, the Cletus is really, really expensive.
By the way, thanks to Good Sound for hipping us to the correct meaning of that. It's crystal LED integrated system.
Great.
So that's what Cletus means. Chris, you found some other interesting micro LED companies, Aledia, for example, Lumiode, Leti.
Yeah.
what were some of those guys doing?
Lumiode and Leti are both doing all three of them are doing this micro display based approach, and they just have different kinds of ways of doing this bonding mechanism. And it gets pretty detailed into what exactly they're doing here.
And we're seriously into propeller head land here. Let's look at Lumiode Fig 1, and we should see something of what Lumiode is doing.
Yeah, and these are all semiconductor technologies now. So
right.
It's about the processing and matching managing the crystal structure mismatch between these two different materials, one silicon, one in gallium nitride.
Right. Indium gallium nitride. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the Leti. This is a new process for flipping these things over. One of the advantages of this approach is these are both silicon wafer scale processes here. So you can potentially do this on 8-inch or 12-inch wafers as opposed to the 2 or 4-inch wafers that the micro LED materials is typically fabricated on. Mm. And this is very early days for this kind of a scheme here.
Mm-hmm. And then the Lumiode would be the other one to take a quick look at if we can find it.
Yeah. So this one, they actually start with the LED wafer, which again is kind of small, but now they grow silicon on top of this and then fabricate the transistors on top of it. So it's again, different ways of skinning the cat here. Mm-hmm. Still early days. So you've got this mating and integration problem, but more importantly, after you've done all this, you still only have one color. It's either blue or green. So
oh,
now
man,
you've got
to
add
do it
some
three
color
times.
Conversion.
Or do some color conversion, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I,
yeah.
I think that makes it fair to say that this is really cool stuff, but it's a little out there. Unless price is, even if price is no object, I think I should say, or if you want anything bigger than sort of a very small display.
Mm-hmm. Speaking
of
micro display,
this is going to be very cool for AR and VR, where you want this really high pixel pitch and density.
Exactly. That's about where I was going to go, because what I've seen of AR and VR so far, so to speak, is VR anyway. You put on the goggles. You can easily see the pixel structure. It feels low res. It just doesn't look very good. And so what we're talking about here is being able to improve that significantly so that the VR headset, you know, looks more photorealistic, which it certainly doesn't now.
Right.
That was one of the other trends, is that there was, in terms of people making stuff that are bought to go into later products, there's a lot of attention to higher density, small size displays so that you can get to what you would call an 8K display for VR, but that's actually 4K per eye, or the 2250 DPI display that Samsung had.
Mm-hmm. Chris, you had an interesting idea about how we should be thinking about micro displays and AR, VR displays, and what's important in your mind?
I think the important metric is pixels per degree. So you can take a display, whatever the resolution, just to say it's 2K by 2K, and if you put that into a 50-degree field of view, you're going to have a much tighter pixels per degree and a much cleaner image than if you spread that out over 200 degrees or 120 degrees or whatever. Mm. The bigger the field of view, the more pixelation, the more screen door effect you're going to see. So it doesn't really make sense to talk about field of view without talking about the display resolution. And it doesn't make sense to talk about display resolution without talking about field of view. So why not combine them?
Why not combine them? So why is it that people are mostly talking about pixels per inch at this point?
Well, I think that's historically how they've talked about it. And we just need to evolve the discussion.
Well, and the phone and tablet guys are driving that because they don't have the same wide viewing angle issue as a VR or AR headset would be.
And good point.
You'll listen to Apple or Samsung for their new phones, and they'll say a bazillion DPI, my thing is better.
Right. BKK Canuck is saying, if you have 8K total and 4K per eye, you must have four eyes. in a sense, that's true. But I think the point is, you know, that you basically get half of 8K per eye if you have a total 8K display. One of the other things I thought was very interesting at the show was light field. Now, I've had a couple of people on the show to talk about light field technology. One from Lytro, makers of the camera that is used to capture light fields. And we're not going to get into exactly what light fields are here. But suffice to say, they simulate when we're out looking in the real world, light comes at us from all these different directions. And a light field camera captures that information, and a light field display displays that information such that you get glasses-free 3D. Now, we all know the 3D in consumer TVs has come and gone yet again. but there are applications for a glasses-free 3D light field type display. Mike, did you see anything of these, the Lia or the Tianma?
Yeah, I didn't see them in reality on the show floor, but it was brought up in a number of the papers. And you're right. It's really something that they're pointing initially towards medical applications. So picture an otoscope, which you'd want to use if your kid complains that they have an ear infection. This would make it easier for the pediatrician to see what's literally going on in there. Or another really innovative way to think about this is for tumor diagnosis for breast cancer exams. Is it a tumor? Is it something to really worry about? Or is it a cyst? Mm-hmm. And this was brought up as two really big potential applications.
Right. We have you took a picture of us at Samsung, the Samsung Light Field OLED, which it sort of shows something of how light fields work.
And that's the poor person on the right there who needs their wig put on. you know, that's an example of what they of what they were talking about. Or another thing that we haven't talked about, because this is Home Theater Geeks, but a lot of the display technologies were also aimed at heads-up and automotive displays. And a lot of the curved and bendable displays were intended for swooping into the dashboard of a car or being used for a heads-up display. And that was one of the applications for this light field technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's not forget about AR and VR. That's clearly going to be another application area.
Of light field.
Light field display. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I did see the LEIA, the L-E-I-A display. That we have a graphic of that called LEIA 1. And they were showing, it's funny, I walked up to them and I said, I can see you got these 3D, glasses-free 3D displays here, smallish. You know, are you looking at TVs at all? And he says, nah, TVs, 3D, it wasn't really well accepted. It's kind of gone now. We're looking at other things. And it was interesting because you had this kind of, you didn't have quite the same rigid, you know, you could stand almost anywhere and see a 3D effect. So it was a lot better than most glasses-free 3D that I've seen based on lenticular types of filters. This is a different technology called light field. And I thought it worked pretty well. And then we also have, what's the other one that we have here? Tianma. I didn't see them.
Yeah, they were in the eye zone. And this is one of the approaches for a light field display is to create this kind of volumetric image that appears above the display. So it has parallax both in the horizontal and the vertical direction. Mm-hmm. So you can have look around in any direction, basically. But what Tianma did was something a little different. They took the same idea and said, well, we're just going to focus all these little micro lenses onto a flat plane at one level. And so that becomes a floating image.
Wouldn't that be cool?
An out of body video. I missed that.
I'm sorry, what?
An out of body video.
An out of body video. I love it.
You're floating.
I love it. I'm sorry I missed those guys in the eye zone. I was talking with Pixel Display, or trying to anyway.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're just about out of time, but before we go, there's one last thing that I want to show, which sort of is display related, but sort of not. Chris, you turned me on to this. I missed it entirely, and I'm really sorry I did. A transparent directional speaker from Turtle Beach. And actually, I found a YouTube of it. You in fact, sent me a link to a YouTube video of this. And if Josh can pull it up, I would love to play that and then get some perspective. Check it out. The sound is coming from that clear thing he's moving around.
An exact month trying out every single headset in the marketplace. And then all of a sudden, Turtle Beach says, hey, we have a new product coming out.
There were a lot of things that we asked for, a lot of things that we were looking for. So thankfully, Turtle Beach listened to us, listened to the input with the Elite Pro. Between the comfortability of the headphones and the actual audio quality at the tournaments, I think we were close.
Yeah, this thing is extremely directional. It was right next to the Pixel Display guys.
I'm sorry I missed it. I totally missed it.
But just as a basis for comparison, I did see or hear, if you will, the Turtle Beach thing, and I'll be curious to see if they show it at E3 in mid-June. But if you were from the audio side of the audience, if you were to compare that to the LG demo of the speaker in glass or the thing in the Sony Bravia, it didn't have the SPL and it didn't have the dispersion that the other things did.
Well, in this case, they didn't want dispersion. They wanted it to be highly directional.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But and if you're thinking about that for a home theater, you wouldn't want it.
No. But it's perfect for a museum exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Or for gaming.
If you had two or three
people gaming in the same room, they could be on different screens and not hear each other, what the other one's hearing. I can think of if it were made better fidelity, I could think of, a situation where you might be watching TV and the person next to you wants to be reading and doesn't want to hear it as loud as you want to play it. You could easily do that. It does. It did remind me, Mike, of the Sony, what they call it, acoustic surface.
Yeah.
Which is where the Sony OLED, the entire screen vibrates and sends out sound. And so this kind of reminded me of that, but the directionality was really interesting, and the whole thing was just super cool.
Well, it's also done in a different way. The Sony Bravias and the LG prototype that they were also showing again are transducer based, and this is some other magical something.
Right. Which I'm going to learn more.
Saw acoustics, I think.
Saw acoustics?
Yeah, surface acoustic waves, I think.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm going to do more research on that, and maybe we'll get somebody from Turtle Beach on to explain it to us. Anyway, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour, and I want to thank you both for being here very much. That's Chris Chinnick, the founder and president of Insight Media, and you can find out more about him at insightmedia.com. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right. And Mike Heiss, you can find his work at residentialsystems.com and at twice.com. Mike, always glad to have you.
And hiddenwires.co.uk.
And hiddenwires.co.uk. Thank you so much again for being here.
Thanks as always.
Okay.
You can always find me at at avsforum.com. That's my web address. But you can email me also at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be David Miles Huber, a Grammy-nominated surround sound engineer who is just now releasing a Blu-ray of original music recorded and mixed in Oro 3D immersive sound. So we're going to talk with him about the process and how it compares to other immersive sound formats. Should be quite fascinating, and I do hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.